Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States First Technical Sergeant Ralph G. Morales, ACM 39018. Appellant presents one issue for our consideration during argument today. It is whether the application of Executive Order 13696, which eliminated the constitutionally required exception to the psychotherapist patient privilege, was one, an abuse of the military judge's discretion, or two, deprived appellant of his right to confront his accuser, to compulsory process, or to due process of law. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes, thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, may I please report. My name is Kurt Cipriano, and I am on the duty of the Sergeant Morales. Sergeant Morales respectfully requests that this court set aside the findings and sentence hearing order because the failure to conduct an independent review of the mental health record in question here is a violation of the substantial constitutional rights. The Supreme Court in Pennsylvania versus Richmond explained that a qualified privilege cannot overcome a defendant's right to discover a scope of evidence. In that case, I issue the child and youth services records associated with the victim, and the Supreme Court of the United States determined that it was a violation of due process to not produce a document and review of the records. The standard that the court set is a very low bar. In the court's opinion, it talks about how the defendant had alleged that the production of the court's records, the child services records, would provide them with potential other witnesses' names and other unspecified exposures.
And counsel, in your assignment of error, you allege that the military, well, your client was deprived of his right to confront his accuser, to compulsory process, or to due process of law. In Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, I believe the Supreme Court rejected that argument in terms of right to confront under the Sixth Amendment, correct?
I think it's correct.
And to compulsory process, correct?
I think they did not evaluate the compulsory process, but basically came to the conclusion that the compulsory process clause provides at least as much protection as the due process clause. I think you're correct,
and I just want to make sure that's where we're going to focus, or you seem to be focusing your argument at this point, correct?
I think that's as an initial matter, that is correct, Your Honor. I think that the question becomes whether or not he would have had. So there hasn't been a court case from the Supreme Court that Collins is aware of that addresses this in terms of the compulsory process clause, because in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, that was dispositive. I think in this case, what we're talking about is whether or not there's a qualified privilege, and whether or not, as a matter of due process, the appellant or defendant in a trial has made a sufficient showing requiring him review. This court has recognized in Chisholm, as the Supreme Court has recognized, an in-camera review does very little violence to the any kind of privilege, because by its nature, it is secretive. Protected, it's a protected disclosure to a certain degree. Now, if this court determines that it is constitutionally required for the due process, then the next question becomes whether or not whether the records in question are in possession of the government makes a difference from a constitutional standpoint to the defendant. And the compulsory process clause, I think that at that point it would trigger the requirement to use the compulsory process clause to obtain the records in question here and review them for the purposes of determining whether or not there was additional evidence that could be beneficial to the defendant. And I'll talk about prejudice in a moment, but the Supreme Court, when addressing the use of the compulsory process clause in the United States versus Nixon, of course, that's a famous case where Nixon was trying to hide recorded conversations under the presidential privilege, the Supreme Court made a statement talking about the compulsory process clause and how it's necessary in the interest of justice that it be used for both the prosecution and the defense. Now, of course, the compulsory process clause, by its own terms, is a clause that is for the benefit of the accused, and it says the accused shall enjoy the right to compel production of documents. So it shouldn't make a difference from a constitutional or prejudice standpoint whether or not the government has these records in its possession or whether it can subpoena them. I mean, the defendant has a constitutional right to subpoena them because they were exculpatory. And again, there isn't a case where the Supreme Court has specifically addressed the compulsory process clause. This hasn't been reached as far as the comments in the
When we talk about Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, we compare it, the facts that were there in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, where the Supreme Court did say that it was required for in-camera review, and there was a much stronger showing than was here. You know, it's just regurgitated. The standard from Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, essentially, he basically said, hey, I might find some witnesses' names, and there might be other stuff in there that can help my case. And the Supreme Court said, yes, we must conduct in-camera review. Here, there was much more. You know, the defendant, to the complaining witness, Ms. Y.M., produced the 4 pages out of what appeared to be years of mental health records that were inculpatory. But those records specifically said that there were other potential sources of injury. She said she admitted to being abused by Mr. AUA over the course of their relationship. And as the comment noted in his brief, Mr. AUA continued to see Ms. YM over the course of the time that the charges were alleged. So in other words, she was seeing Mr. AUA while she was seeing Mr. Technical Sergeant Morales. In addition, she names her boss as another potential source of injury. She says, you know, her boss had threatened violence against her and she was afraid of him. And finally, those 3 pages she produced talk about how, they don't name a client specifically, they name her boyfriend. And on the record, we noticed that she was also seeing Mr. J.B. throughout the course of her relationship with the appellant, and he is another potential source of injury. So when we look at whether or not he should have been produced for in-camera review, we ask the court to consider the potential use of the other potential parts of the mental health records. Now, if the judge had complied with Pennsylvania versus Ritchie and ordered in-camera review, produced them and reviewed them in camera, there's only one of two possible outcomes as far as the count can discern. Either he looks at them and he says, yes, she talks about other abusers, she talks about the count again, and she talks about them on these pages, and he gets those records. That will assist him if, for example, she named Mr. AUA or Mr. JB as a potential abuser. The evidentiary importance of that should be obvious. But even if the judge, that's one outcome, something affirmative comes out where she talks about some other abuse. The other potential outcome would be that there is no abuse. The judge looks at it and says, hey, look, I looked at everything. There is nothing else in there about abuse at all. Well, that is still something that the defense could potentially have used because the defense in criminal cases is permitted to argue any reasonable inference from the absence of evidence. So in that particular case, if there was no other evidence, they could have even asked the military judge, say, hey, Your Honor, can you please take notice that you looked at the rest of these mental health records, confirmed that there was nothing else other than this one page. And then at trial, they could have used that against, or in their defense, rather, by saying, the military judge looked at all of the potential abuses, or looked at the mental health records. Only on this one time did he say anything about mental health, about physical abuse by the accountant, and arguably not by the accountant, arguably by the boyfriend. No other time did he mention it. You were being seen throughout the course of the alleged abuse by the mental health professional. So in either event, they would have had some sort of potentially exculpatory evidence that they could have used that would have been developed during the interview.
Couldn't they have asked those questions anyway?
Could they have asked whether she made statements?
No other complaints, no prior reports? Couldn't she have been confronted in that respect without piercing this privilege?
I think she, of course she could have, Your Honor. I mean, she, you can ask any questions that are not objectionable, but the question is really about whether or not, I mean, to what weight would that have? And again, one of the important aspects of this, the appellant asked this court to consider when considering this, is that she produced some small portion of the documents herself. Apparently, and it's not clear from the record, but apparently she produced them and gave them to the government, just these four pages that were in the public court. And this is the kind of action, as an appellant knows, and upon understand that he's not arguing the fact that she's court per se, but with respect to the credibility of the witness and with respect to requiring the military judge to conduct an in-camera review, this fact pattern is the kind of fact pattern that screams out for a judge to review the records, determine whether or not this person has got a demonstrated motive to misrepresent and bias against the appellant is cherry-picking mental health records for the purposes of exploiting the military's trial for her own personal gain at a later date. In other words, the court should look at this skeptically. I mean, the fact that she chose to produce only four records out of years of mental health records should have rang some alarm bells with the judge, particularly where the government at trial had already agreed that and had already turned over the mental health records and basically agreed in Appellate Exhibit 7 in response to the discovery request that these records were germane and that they were going to have them produced and have the military judge review them in camera. And Tom would also ask this court to consider when making its determination on this case that the position the government takes now on appeal that the defendant didn't make a sufficient showing to require an in-camera review is a complete 180 from trial where they basically said they were going to do it. In addition to the constitutional requirements of the production here, the military judge used his discretion by applying this new rule of evidence when he didn't need to. In the savings clause, it talks about how it need not be applied in actions where charges are already been referred. And that was the case here. And I understand that the government wants to point to arraignment, but that is the traditionally the point in time when jeopardy attaches. Now, the executive order is whether or not the executive order applies and should apply in an action is a separate question from that. So appellant would argue that in this case, where there is a discovery request already out and the defendant appears to have made his showing to require the government to produce records for in-camera review, the decision to retroactively apply the rule was a violation, was outside the range of reasonable choices which the judge should have made. He should have allowed it to continue under the old rule. And finally, Collin would argue that the act of Congress and the President of removing the constitutionally required exception was a nullity, and that by its own terms, the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution applies. And if the evidence is constitutionally required, then it should have been produced and the camera could be viewed, should have been ordered. If there are no questions, I will briefly conclude.
Well, I'd like to get back to counsel. You mentioned that during the period of time when the offenses, when the abuse had occurred, she continued to see Mr. AUA, but that was there, the evidence was that their relationship had terminated in 2006, is that correct?
That's correct, and when I said see, I meant just physically see, they weren't romantically involved at that point.
And I believe the evidence was that seeing was in the context of child custody arrangements where they would be exchanging custody.
That certainly is what she testified to, yes, Your Honor. She didn't testify to anything.
And was there any more indication that during the the charge time frame, Mr. AUA was the source of any particular injury.
Well, I believe that they sort of hinted at an allegation of potential abuse by him, but that was it. There wasn't any specific testimony from her that he abused her during that time frame. But the appellant's view is that that demonstrates the need for these particular records. And she talked about abuse and abuse she suffered, and it's very likely that she talked about abuse on other occasions that she suffered, and potentially about the occasions, the time frames when the appellant is alleged to be abused.
Counsel, you talked about the witness cherry-picking information or confidential communications to disclose to the government as well as ultimately trial defense counsel. We're dealing with then waiver, correct, under 510 of that privilege, correct?
I think potentially yes, Your Honor. So there's two pieces to the question. I mean, if it's, the appellant's argument is that it's constitutionally required or pierces her privilege that the waiver is irrelevant, but this court could look and determine that she waived that by producing the documents.
To what extent?
I think what's the limitation on that? The appellant's position is that she certainly would have waived, so the documents she produced, was, I believe, in 16 June 2010, was prior to any of the charged misconduct. Her providing that and showing that on these occasions she talked about specific incidences of abuse shortly after they happened, we believe that it would be temporarily limited, but over the course of the charge time. I mean, if the government charged over a period of several years, so we would argue that to the extent that she provided some, she provided the records that address the time of charged conduct would be relevant. Because, I mean, those are the time periods where she potentially would have said something to the therapist about abuse by the So we would, and I don't know what's in those mental health records. The appellant doesn't know, but if there was something that was totally unrelated to abuse or totally unrelated, then potentially the judge could have not provided that as well. But that's exactly why in-camera review is done.
To determine whether or not, what significant part of the confidential communications were disclosed?
Yes, no. Pennsylvania versus Ritchie seems to suggest that exculpatory evidence, I mean, it would be within the judge's discretion. Once the review is triggered, it would be obviously within the judge's discretion to determine what is released to the appellant, and that would be very difficult to attack. But the blanket decision not to conduct in-camera review at all, the appellant would argue is arguing that it's a violation of his due process, right?
Well, I guess, what in this case, under the Constitution, required an in-camera review? What did appellant show at trial in this case that would require under the Constitution an in-camera review?
So the record itself suggested that there were other potential sources of violence and injury. So I think that's the issue, is that if there had been, as we discussed previously, if there had been some affirmative naming of some other party, that would have been quite beneficial to the defense. But even a failure to, after having alleged and talked about abuse on one occasion, even the absence of more discussions regarding abuse would be something that the appellant could use at trial to defend itself. He could have said, "You on this one occasion, you talked about abuse, yeah, but you say that these other occasions happened too." And she would say yes, and he would say, "Well, but there's no other evidence of that in the mental health records." I mean, that is something that they could have used in their defense affirmatively as well, because, as we discussed, the defense is permitted to argue anything that's reasonable from a lack of evidence. So I think that there was really a problem with the failure to conduct the defense.
Towards the beginning of our discussion, you had talked about subpoenas and production. I mean, there are standards for the government to even order production of unprivileged material, correct?
Yes.
How in this case, even, how are the facts in this case, would they have even required production of, if the records were unprivileged? I mean, and that should be, and that's lower than production of privilege communications, right? I'm just talking 703, and you're seeking subpoenas. There has to be a showing by defense counsel, even for unprivileged material to be produced, right?
Well, yes.
And I'm just trying to get an idea of what standard you think trial defense counsel met in this case in requiring, first of all, production, and subsequently an in-camera review of privileged material.
I mean, the appellant's position is that the fact that she names other people in one of these produced documents is more than sufficient to support a finding that there's potential other exculpatory evidence for the purpose of discovery. And that's the position. I mean, certainly this court could say that that's not enough, but you know, I think given the Supreme Court's guidance in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, and I understand there's a distinction between documents that are already within possession of the government, but again, you couple United States versus Ritchie with United States versus Nixon and the compulsory process clause, you know, this is a case where she volunteered the information that lends the credibility to the argument that the documents should be used. I mean, she came out and provided those things, and they show that there are potential other sources, and that she talks about them during the course of she talks about the potential sources and talks about abuse during the course of her therapy. I mean, that and is more than sufficient in the view to support any production in camera review, which is this court and the Supreme Court recognized.
But the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie has also recognized that the Supreme Court has never held that a defendant alone may make the determination as the materiality of information. And that seems to be what maybe you're suggesting, right? Because we say it's material, conduct an in-camera review.
No, I think that the judge, I mean, I don't think it's within the appellant's position. It wasn't within the reasonable discretion of the judge at the point where there is potentially other sources of injury that are named in these records for him to deny the production in camera review and for him to not take a look at them. So, no, we don't believe that the defendant would be the sole decider, but the court, Supreme Court, again, in Ritchie says there's a very low standard. And we believe that standard was met here and that the judge's responsibility to look at this stuff.
So I guess what is that standard? What is the requirement? What do you have to meet as a defendant in order for a trial judge to conduct an in-camera review when privilege is asserted under MRE 513?
I'm sorry. Yes, again.
When privilege is asserted under MRE 513, what is that standard? What is the showing that a defendant in trial in a court martial has to meet in order for a judge to conduct an in-camera review?
I'm not aware of one that is enumerated, or has been specifically said by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. I mean, we approach it looking at, and Ritchie doesn't say any specific standard, it merely says it's met here. When we're talking about discovery requests are you're required to produce anything that is reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence. I mean, I think this is reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence. This was not an issue where there was a fishing expedition. That's the appellant's view. I mean, I think that it was characterized generally, but that was by virtue of the fact that they didn't know what was in there. They just knew that she had talked about abuse and named other potential sources. And when we talk about fishing expeditions, I mean, Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, the appellant recognizes, was about the most fishing expedition that you can name. And they basically just said, you might find other stuff. So I think that the standard isn't very clear in the appellant's view, but it is met here, and it's sufficient to support finding that it would have gotten discoverable and admissible evidence.
Counsel, real quick, in the time we have left, I'd like to go back to a point that you had addressed a little bit earlier with regard to whether these records were in the possession of the government. And you alluded to it, I believe, also a little bit with your discussion with Judge Speranza. So is it your position that, given the existence of the privilege, these records effectively were not in the possession of the government?
I think they just physically weren't. I mean, the rest of the records weren't done. I think as a factual matter, they weren't done. On the record, it appears, Your Honor, that they only had the records she produced. They were going to ask for the remainder of the records, and they did not because, in the interim, the military judge.
decided there was essentially a constitutional exception.
So my recollection may be, and I may be off on this, that perhaps there were some records that were with a civilian provider and some records that were conducted through the military. So I just want to be clear on what your position would be. If there were military records that were covered by 513.
I'd say my time's about up. So you don't maybe I may answer your question.
Absolutely.
Yes, I think so. There would be two separate, and it would make a difference if, and I believe your Honor is correct, there were some records that were within the possession of DOD health services. And it wouldn't make a difference in appellant's view because we're arguing that if you trigger a requirement, the constitution required, it also triggers compulsory process. But Pennsylvania versus Ritchie squarely addresses the question of records within the government's possession, so that would control for sure on those. And then the ones that are in the hands of an LNCMD or a third-party health provider, this court would have to make an extension to kind of compulsory process clause that would require the government as well.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel. I just wanted to clarify and make sure I understood what your position was.
Yes.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam. Senior Judge Mayberry, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Meredith Steer, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, who represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he applied Executive Order 13696 and found that trial defense counsel failed to meet his burden in articulating specific facts that demonstrated in-camera review of Ms. Wyatt's mental health records was required. The application of the executive order also did not deprive appellant of his constitutional rights to confrontation, compulsory process, or due process of law. Now, appellant has spent a great deal of time within his argument and within his reply brief referring to defense exhibit D, which were the three pages of mental health records that were waived, it appears, by Ms. Y and produced. To be clear, those records were not provided to the military judge when defense was making their oral motion for production of mental health records for in-camera review, nor were they provided when appellant made his written briefing on the constitutionality. So it is not appropriate for this court to look to those records and determine that the military judge should have then used those records to find those facts supposedly that would have required production for in-camera review. Trial defense counsel presented no evidence and, in fact, conceded that he was speculating during the motion hearing when he was asked to provide a factual basis for in-camera review. And that's the record at page 50 and 52. You asked the appellant what the standard is for production. I believe that's been announced in United States versus Clement and then was codified in the new version of NRA 513. And that is the standard for an appellant to show that there is a factual basis adequate to support a good faith belief by a reasonable person that in-camera review of the materials may reveal evidence to establish that a claim to an exception applies. It is not enough to just say that Ms. YM was going to a mental health provider at the time, and therefore she might have made statements about this, and she may have said this, and she may have said that. If you look at DB versus Liver in footnote 11 of that case, DB versus Liver, it says it's pretty well recognized that you can't just speculate because somebody has been going to a mental health provider, therefore the records must be reviewed in camera because they may contain relevant information. This case is almost exactly like what happened in DB versus Liver, and that's why I provided a supplemental citation to this court. There, in that case, appellant made only broad generalizations of possible impeachment evidence and repeatedly said may. This is exactly what we have in this case. If you look at the written briefing on the constitutionality, appellant says records might be in the possession of the federal government. It's reasonable to conclude that these records may have these statements. It's reasonable to conclude that the records could possibly be expected to contain her recollections. recollections of statements made or perhaps not made by the accused. And then the appellant went on to concede that naturally the defense can only speculate as to the contents of these counseling records. That is exactly what happened in DB versus Libert. And in fact, in DB versus Libert, the defense tried to say that the communications fell under the child abuse exception, which is what appellant tried to do in this case, and the military judge in both DB versus Libert and in this case rejected that argument. Emory 513, as it stands in the executive order and as it stands today, requires the defendant and the appellant to make a showing by preponderance of the evidence. First, that there's going to be evidence that's relevant, and that's based off of some facts. And then he has to show that those, if they're relevant, fall within one of the exceptions. And appellant could not do that in this case.
Well, because he was arguing that it was a constitutionally required exception, or because he failed to articulate a specific factual basis?
Both, Your Honor. I think even if you were looking at this under the old version of the MRA 513, you were asking a appellant to articulate how these were constitutionally required. He failed to even do that. But more importantly, the new MRA 513, which does not include that exception, he could not tie the records, could not provide facts, first of all, and could not even provide an argument as to how the records would be relevant under one of those exceptions. Appellant also argues that Pennsylvania versus Ritchie would provide an alternative argument based off of the due process clause, that regardless of what Emory 513 says under due process of law, he's entitled to these records. I want to point out, first of all, that Pennsylvania versus Ritchie is dealing with a Pennsylvania statute that specifically provided for the production of counseling records in that case. So on its face, in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, the statute provided a due process. Here, the change to MRA 513, I think very easily you can say that, at least on its face, no longer provides for that due process, and the court has to be looking deeper.
So on its face, it does not provide a criminal defendant due process protections under the Constitution.
On its face, it no longer has the constitutionally required exception. It no longer says, in a criminal case, as in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, in a criminal case, records pertaining to this must be disclosed in that. No longer says that. And so I'm not saying that, of course, I'm not saying that Congress can write with legislation right out of the Constitution. But I think that Congress can, and appropriately can, tailor what the defendant must show in order to have those records be produced. And the appellant, again, conceded that he was speculating. He had no information.
So you say it can tailor what must be shown, but you're also not conceding that argument, that showing is based on a constitutional requirement.
Your Honor, I think under different facts, there may be a case that exists where the defense is able to produce specific facts showing that records may contain exculpatory information. And although those records don't come under any of the enumerated exceptions, there may be a case out there where a judge would say, I find that these records need to be disclosed, and then what the remedy would be from there, I don't know. But those aren't the facts of this case.
So let me just ask you directly. So late last year, this court decided the case of United States versus Chisholm, which rested in its determination that the military judge abused their discretion in not ordering an in-camera review, not conducting an in-camera review, on a constitutional requirement. So what was the effect of the change to this rule on this court's reasoning in Chisholm?
Well, I think Chisholm is distinguishable in two aspects. One, the defense was able to actually bring up facts and show facts of things that two witnesses had said relating to their memory problems. So they met by a preponderance of the evidence that the records would disclose that these individuals had memory problems. Then I think the court would be faced with looking at whether that would fall within one of the enumerated exceptions, and perhaps in Chisholm, the decision would have remained the same regardless of which version of MRA 513 they're looking at.
Because the Constitution still requires what the Constitution required.
That's correct.
Counsel, let me just make sure I understood your point as well. You indicated that there was no reason to do an in-camera review because there was no reason to establish that they were disclosable. that whatever the content of those records were disclosable to the parties?
Sorry, Your Honor. I think that the standard is you do an in-camera review if the defense puts on, by preponderance of the evidence, enough evidence to show that the records would be relevant under one of the exceptions to MRE 513. So yes, Your Honor, they would be disclosable under one of the exceptions.
Okay, but to do that, obviously the judge would have to look at the records.
Correct.
Because you're not going to get to the ability to disclose the content until you know the content.
The defense still has to put on some facts by preponderance of the evidence to get to that point to even look at the record. It's not enough to speculate about what the records contain.
And it's the government's position that under the new version of 513, it still has to be an enumerated exception.
Yes, Your Honor, except for I think there may be a case like Chisholm where there may be some facts in addition to where a judge might, for example, say, I'm going to abate proceedings because I find that the records that I've looked at in camera need to be disclosed, but the victim's asserting her privilege and I don't have a way to disclose them under the exception. Therefore, I'm going to abate the proceedings. And then a victim may decide that she's going to waive her privilege or he's going to waive his privilege with respect to those records. But those facts are simply not before the court today when it comes to this case and what appellant put before this judge when the judge is looking at MRE 513.
I think we've all asked this, probably asked a similar, if not the same question. As MRE 513 is written and as it applies today, can the Constitution require an in-camera review?
I think that's an open question.
I asked it.
I would like to say yes, but I think other individuals may disagree on reading Jackie versus Redmond and what the privilege may say. And so a judge may say, I'm not even going to do an in-camera review, I'm just going to obey. But I will say that I recognize that our Superior Court's case law is that no congressional legislation can overcome the Constitution. And so if a judge were determined that the only recourse in the case was to do an in-camera review and a victim was adamant that that was not even something that she was inclined to agree to, then a judge could abate. But I also think based off of...
Well, my question is, can the judge conduct an in-camera review, not abate?
I think so, Your Honor. I think there's nothing that's been written into the rules that says, for example, under the attorney-client privilege, that a military judge can't do an in-camera review. And we know from past case law, although rare, a military judge or another judge in a different jurisdiction could do an in-camera review of attorney-client privilege material. So I think that is permissible, although other things.
You had mentioned Jaffe versus Redmond. To what extent should our analysis be informed by federal common law as it applies, I guess, really specifically to MRE 513?
Well, Your Honor, as MRE 513, written by, or as enacted by the President, to the extent that there's been a question that's been left open, I think you can look to the federal common law and what federal but recognizing that in the military context, at least in discovery and in statutes under Article 46, that's all written by statute. That's not controlling by the Constitution. So I think you can look to where federal case law has treated different issues if aligned with what our rules.
Well, that's the point under 501, to the extent that it's compatible, correct? And to what extent is Jaffe versus Redmond and its lineage compatible with MRE 513 as written?
Well, understanding that Jaffe versus Redmond was a civil case, but in the federal common law, I know that the law says we're going to let the judiciary develop our rules of privilege. And so there isn't the direction by Congress and direction by the executive, but it's to the extent that they are aligned, I think they can look to the federal rules as stated in 501. But to the extent that Congress and the President have further limited how this, how the military must treat privileges, then you have to go by the more restrictive interpretation.
So is MRE 513 more restrictive than what its counterpart MRE 501 is, as developed by federal common law?
I don't think it is, actually. I think Jaffe versus Redmond is stricter than what we have.
So when MRE 513 was created, it was deliberately constructed as a more permissive rule?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. Although the first version of MRE 513, I think, was probably enacted in the legislative history, appears to say that it was codified to take the rule from Jaffe versus Redmond and apply it in a military context. But as stated in DB versus Libert, and as we all know, a matter of a mental health record being produced in a court martial became almost commonplace. And so I think that's the legislative history behind the new version of MRE 513 and why it became more restrictive and required this showing by defense of a specific facts to do an encounter review. And along with Pennsylvania versus Ritchie and where the due process is provided by statute, I think this court can also look to Kinder versus White, which is cited from the government brief from the Fourth Circuit. And I just briefly want to touch on Appellant's argument that the executive order savings clause perhaps should have required the military judge to not employ the new executive order. I disagree with Appellant's interpretation of what that executive order states. As interpreted by sister court, Navy Marine Corps, and Roberts, the exact same provisions were interpreted when it related to good military character evidence under MRE 404. And there, in Roberts, the court stated that because appellant was arraigned after the date that the executive order went into effect, that is a separate part of a trial, as that savings clause has been interpreted, and therefore the executive order applies since it was enacted before the date of and CAF denied petition for review in that case in 2016. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes, please.
The military judge correctly ruled that appellant failed to meet his burden in articulating specific facts that demonstrated in-camera review of Ms. YM's mental health records was required. Appellant conceded that the information he sought did not fall under any of the exceptions to MRE 513, and its application did not violate appellant's right to confrontation, compulsory process, or due process of law. The military judge did not err in appellant's conviction, and sentence should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
To be clear, the appellant is arguing that whatever the standard of whatever the requirements imposed upon the military, on a defendant by military rule of evidence 513, they cannot limit, they can't be more restrictive than those required under the due process clause. In other words, if the standard for due process is more generous to the defendant, that endures the defendant's benefit. So to the extent that 513 imposes additional requirements beyond Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, that requiring him to review, the appellant argues that that is not permissible. In Shuffer versus United States, or I believe it's United States versus Shuffer, the Supreme Court of the United States looked at specifically the rulemaking authority of Congress and the President, and they said that it was limited. They could make, they had broad authority to make rules, but it was limited where it infringed upon the constitutional rights of the defendant. And so that's one piece of it. And you see that, again, with the removal of the constitutional required exception under Shepard, I mean, obviously, if your very purpose is to remove the times when a rule allows constitutionally required evidence, by definition, you are infringing upon a weighty constitutional interest. confused. And that's your purpose. And just a very brief hypothetical, we would demonstrate why Congress cannot do that. Let's say Congress makes Rule of Evidence 577B, I just made that number up, where, and it says, in all courts martial, a defendant may not testify on his own behalf, and any testimony he gives is not admissible. I think that would be plainly, you know, I think the Constitution would plainly control that under the government's argument that the Congress and the President can remove evidence when it's constitutionally required. They would be able to make that rule, and the Congress would submit that that's not permissible under the Constitution or under the United States v. Shepard.
Well, counsel, there are other military rules of evidence that recognize privileges that impact an accused's ability to secure material information from the government, correct?
Right, there are, yes, Your Honor. And there are rules that don't specifically enumerate a constitutionally required exception, I'm sure. But the appellant's view is that the exception, when it's specifically listed, is really just surplusage. I mean, if it is required by the Constitution, it is required by the Constitution. The Constitution, by its own terms, it says it is the supreme law of the land. If there is a constitutional right of a defendant in a criminal trial, the government cannot abrogate that right by making a rule of evidence.
Well, so would your argument be the same if we were talking about records that were kept by her legal assistance attorney or her military chaplain?
I think we would have to view that. And so in those cases, the Supreme Court has always weighed each privilege differently. So I think that potentially would be, but you know, with respect to the attorney-client privilege, there's a clear difference between psychotherapy or a therapist and an attorney in that an attorney, when you consult an attorney, it is always with the purpose of consulting for the purposes of litigation. When you consult with a therapist, it's for therapy, it's for mental health, for getting better. It's not for the purpose of litigation. So in that respect, the Supreme Court has been more jealously guarded the attorney-client privilege. And the appellant isn't aware of any case that specifically addressed the difference between the psychotherapist and the attorney-client privilege head on. But certainly, in the research for this case, we looked at the attorney-client privilege comes up. The appellant's position is that the attorney-client privilege probably has a higher degree of protection. As far as the clerk penetrating the clergy, the penetrating clergy privilege, the appellant just couldn't find any specific cases where a defendant has attempted to pry open the penitent clergy privilege, and that's probably as a practical matter due to the fact that appellant's understanding is that priests don't write notes when someone needs to confess.
Well, and the reason I ask the question is because if I understood your argument, you were suggesting that whatever the due process clause requires is immovable and can't be impacted by any military rule of evidence that the President or Congress might come up with.
I think that's correct. I mean, I think it would be within the courts. I mean, that's what the courts determine is whether or not, as a matter of due process, this particular law is violative of his due process rights, constitutional rights. And so, yes, if due process requires it, or Constitution requires it, by its own terms, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
So that constitutional requirement's not an exception?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. That's appellant's view. And I understand my time is up. Thank you very much. If there's no further questions.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course, and this court is now closed.